Yeah, that's too bad. I don't know.
Welcome to another episode of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is February 7th, 2012. Now, for tonight's program, just like all of our programs, I would love to have the audience input with questions and comments. If you join the Virtual Auditorium and Pal Talk, you can send them to me via text. Or if you're listening in through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. I do monitor the email during the program, so I'll get it hopefully before the end of the program. And our pages, our guests also have pages on our website, so you just click on the names in the left-hand column, and you'll go straight to their page. Our listeners can also find out which guest is on which show, and so forth and so on. Lots of great information to be found there, as well as links to blogs, Facebook, Twitter, and even Google+. And for all of our fans that are also foodies, we've got a fun project coming up as we put together a cookbook. So be sure to go to the website and find out how to submit a recipe yourself. Now, recipe submissions have been a little bit slow, and we're encouraging everybody to submit them as soon as possible. So we're going to start off with some sort of a fun little drawing and get them in. We'll be offering a prize over the next few weeks from our random drawings and the submissions we've received. And then we might have another drawing or two along the way. So we haven't decided yet what the prize is going to be, but it's not going to be anything big enough that you're going to have to worry about paying taxes on it. But it's sure to be something that anybody who cooks or eats will love. Now, moving right along, tonight we've got a really fun guest and a name that most of us are quite familiar with in the paranormal realm, as he's written numerous books on various topics within it. Tonight, the focus of our conversation will be his latest release, Keep Out, and the secrets he's uncovered. So, Nick Redfern, welcome to the program. And just in case we have some listeners who might not be familiar with you and your work, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hey, Jay. Thanks for having me on the show again. Well, I work sort of author, journalist, lecturer, and research primarily the UFO subject, and my other big interest, cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. And that's sort of basically what I do. You know, I sort of run around investigating things and writing about them and talking about them. You know, whether it's Roswell Area 51, you know, the latest site of the Chupacabra, anything that's sort of a bit weird like that, I kind of get involved in.
That has to be a fun way to make a living, I have to admit, chasing after goblins.
It's contrary to what a lot of people think. It's not exactly the world's best paid job, you know. A lot of people sometimes assume I'm sort of driving around in a Ferrari and living in a mansion, which is about as far away from the truth as you could get. But, you know, I don't complain because I do something I enjoy. But I don't recommend, if you want to earn a good living, that you become a paranormal author.
Well, this is true. This is true. A lot of people assume that all authors are rich and living the lifestyle of the rich and famous, and having known numerous authors over the years. That's not true by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
well,
paranormal
again, don't get me wrong.
Don't
get me wrong, I'm not complaining, you know, because I prefer to do something I enjoy than, you know, do something I hate, basically, for 50 years. But, you know, by the same token, it has the downside is, you know, it's certainly not something, you know, as I say, if you've got two kids or whatever, you know, me and my wife don't have kids, but, you know, it would be a hard, tough life bringing up a family and everything else on, you know, an author's income. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's not exactly, again, you're not going to be buying a house in Beverly Hills anytime soon, I suspect.
No. Or anywhere.
Yeah. I know that song and dance quite well. A lot of people assume that radio show hosts are also living the lifestyle of rich and famous. And once again, I can assure you that, no.
I mean, good luck for people, you know, if they can make a, you know,
an excellent living, and the rest of us, hi.
You do what you have to do to survive, so.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun anyhow.
Maybe that's
what some of us look for, is things we enjoy versus things that just have a nice paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, you see plenty of 50-year-old stressed-out businessmen drop down dead of a heart attack, and what did he get them? You know, nothing at the end of the day, so.
Right, or, you know, all these people that spend their 50 weeks of the year in absolute misery so they can have 2 weeks of vacation and do what it is they really want to do.
Yeah. No, you know, I think a lot of it is dependent on how people, you know, their approach to life and different things. And, we all have to pay bills, but equally you have to, we get one life. You at least make it a good time, you know.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, because we do, in general, those of us who are fortunate enough to chase our rainbows, we may not find the pot of gold at the end of it, but we have a really good time looking for it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, your latest book is called Keep Out, Top Secret Place Governments Don't Want You to Know About. Now, you know, that one, I mean, even the title is intriguing, you know, you can't help but want to pick something like that up. What was your first inspiration towards this book?
Well, you know, I think when people talk about UFOs and information being hidden from us, etc., one of the natural questions to ask is, well, where is it all being hidden? You know, it can't just be sort of stored in the open or we'd know all about it. And, of course, the first place everybody inevitably thinks of is Area 51. You know, that's the one off-limits installation, if you like, that more than any other, I think, everybody identifies with or knows of. And, you know, that doesn't just apply to people in the UFO field. You know, you ask any sort of kid probably 8 years old and upwards, you know, what's Area 51? And they'll say, oh, that's where the UFOs are or the aliens are. Yeah, everybody knows the story. It's become part of pop culture. But one of the reasons, sort of the inspiration behind writing the book, was that a lot of people, particularly outside the, you know, the UFO field, don't really necessarily realize that, you know, there are numerous places all around the planet equally similar to Area 51, and in some ways the stories behind them are more significant. So, you know, it's to really to demonstrate to people that, yeah, Area 51's the one everybody knows about, but at the end of the day, it's actually one of many that most people don't know about. So, you know, I thought, well, why not try and sort of redress the balance and tell people about, you know, but not in literal terms, but, you know, Area 52 or Area 53, you know, that kind of equivalent, if you like.
What a lot of people think of these places and the conspiracies surrounding these secret places and whatnot, you know, there's also these pop culture stories about anybody who tries to probe the secrets, you know, has the Men in Black and other assorted modern-day G-men, boogeymen, coming after them and trying to, you know, do dastardly deeds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the process of doing this investigation, did you have any encounters of the unpleasant sort?
No, I didn't. I mean, you know, I think when you look at the Men in Black story, you know, they're definitely interesting, but it seems for the most part that it's the witnesses and the people with accounts to relate that sort of get the visits and the warnings, you know, because, which is understandable because, you know, if you're in the business of keeping people silent, well, those of us in the UFO field that do the research, you know, we aren't actually in possession, if you like, of secrets that, you know, our own secrets, the secrets that other people have told us about. So in other words, if you want to silence people, then they're going to go direct to the witnesses and tell them not to talk, you know, and put them off from speaking to us. So I suspect that's why, you know, most UFO researchers don't get sort of that, you know, late night knock on the front door from the Men in Black, purely and simply because it's easier and more profitable from their perspective to go to the person who might leak the story, and then the researcher or the author never finds out about it anyway.
Did you have any problems with, you know, say, like, witnesses that said, oh, yeah, I'll talk to you, and then they said, no, I changed my mind, I'm not gonna?
Yeah, that sort of thing I've experienced quite a few times where, you know, somebody may approach you initially and wants to relate a story, maybe, you know, a 40, 50, 60-year-old story in some cases. You know, something occurred to them when they were in the military when they were, like, 22, and now they're something like 83 or 4. And on a number of occasions, you know, people have spoken to me and have been enthusiastic about speaking, not necessarily to have their story published, but just to share it and hope someone can help them answer the story. But then over time, you know, they're like, well, no, I decided not to after all, you know, change my mind, etc. And sometimes, you know, I've got sort of fragments of stories where it sounds like, you know, somebody has suggested to them, hey, you know, it'd be a good idea if you didn't talk, because remember that nice pension you get every month from the military, you know, and it's not kind of like where there even has to be a sinister threat, you know, it's more along the lines of the everyday things of, you know, you talk about this, we'll take away your pension, how are you going to pay your electric bill? The normal logistics of everyday life, rather than, you know, the threat of a bullet in the head that actually convinced a lot of people not to talk. And I would say that's probably happened over the course of sort of 20 years, at least probably 14 or 15 times where I've had sort of weird experiences where somebody's clammed up after initially wanting to speak, and they've alluded to, well, you know, I got this weird phone call from someone saying it's a good idea not to talk about this or that, and you know, and then they, quite understandably, it made them reluctant to talk, and, you know, what can you do? You can't sort of, you know, twist somebody's arm and force them to talk if they don't want to. You know, you just have to accept that unless you can find some other inroad to the story, you know, you're kind of against a brick wall, really.
Uh-huh. We've got a bunch of questions popping up in the virtual auditorium about, you might say, your personal history, about whether or not you were in the Royal Air Force.
No. The only jobs I've ever had other than a writer, or a van driver, and a forklift driver. That's it. No, I left school, useless at school, no qualifications, walked out, didn't know what I was going to do, no college, no university, no academic qualifications, just I'd got nothing, you know, and it's like, what am I going to do in this big world? And I just thought, I enjoyed reading books, but I was useless at school. And I thought, well, I enjoy reading books, why not try and write them? My dad was in the British Royal Air Force. That might be where people are getting confused. He worked on radar. He did his national service, which in the U.S. was the draft, you know, back in the 50s, the British government had the equivalent of the draft called national service. And my dad did that in the Air Force. He worked on radar. So that might be what people are thinking of.
Yeah. Another question that has popped up is, when did you move to the U.S. from the U.K.?
I moved here about 12 years ago, so 11 years ago, 12 years ago almost, and live in Dallas. And my wife's originally from Texas, although she grew up in the Cayman Islands, and she didn't move back here herself till she was like 20-something. And so, you know, we sort of got a kind of a really sort of geographic relationship. You know, I'm born in England, she was born in Texas, moved to the Cayman Islands, and then, you know, now we live just outside Dallas, so we're kind of from all over the place.
Yeah, Dallas is an interesting city. It's also one of the largest in the United States. It's probably an interesting base, though, for you, because it's sort of a centralized location for the northern North American continent.
Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't sort of pick it for that reason. I mean, you know, as I said, my wife's originally from Texas, and, you know, I've spent a lot of time here, and we both like the Dallas area. You know, we're not sort of country people. We don't like the quiet life. City's got plenty to do. So, you know, we moved here, and, you know, as I said, there's plenty to do and places to go, and, you know, contrary again to what a lot of people think, you know, my life doesn't revolve around UFOs, you know, that's what part of what I do, you know, but I enjoy just doing normal things as everybody else, you know. It's I sort of have that, you know, that switch off time. I try and usually just stick to regular, you know, working hours in terms of writing. I mean, you know, when you're doing promotion, like stuff like we're doing tonight, you know, I'm always happy to do that and please when people have me on the shows. But in terms of actual work, I usually try and stick to like 7 till about 7 a.m. till 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. And then, you know, I do the normal everyday things after, you know, we meet, go out with drinks with friends or dinner or go to the cinema or go and see a band or, you know, I'm big into football or soccer as it's called over here. So, you know, I've got a couple of subscription channels. I watch a couple of hours of soccer every night. You know, I just, that's my other interest, you know, outside of all this. You know, I'm not sort of, you know, in it 24/7 just pondering on what happened at Roswell at midnight, you know.
A lot of people think, working at home, you know, that's so nice, you know. But working at home can be really, really challenging, which is anybody who's ever done it can tell you. Do you find anything about working at home?
I guess when I first started, you know, when I was like when I first finished school, I began working on a rock music magazine in England called Zero, and I did that for a few years, but that was like in a 9-to-5 office setting. But when I first went freelance, you know, you think initially, wow, you've got all this time, you know, and it's like a working holiday, but it isn't like that, because if you don't get up and do the work and, you know, I'm on the phone probably an hour and a half a day, because, you know, I don't just write books. You know, I couldn't earn a living from writing UFO books, so I work as a regular journalist and a freelance journalist. So, you know, I'm constantly pitching stories to newspapers, just, you know, just regular journalism stories. And I also do a lot of ghost writing. I do a lot of website content writing for law firms, handling medical lawsuits. I do a lot of that, and so a lot of my writing is nothing to do with paranormal stuff at all, but it's all done from home. But if you don't, you know, if you think, oh, I'm just going to lay in bed till 10 in the morning, you know, when the bills come in, how are you going to pay them? You know, so you have to be disciplined and get up and, you know, crank it out. So.
Yeah, for most people, that discipline is a very important thing to learn, as well as the discipline of learning to tell family no, because they assume since you work at home, you're always free.
Well, I think that's probably more in the past. I mean, a lot of people today do work from home, you know, regardless of what their job is. You know, a lot of people sort of, you know, commute through the internet nowadays, and I think certainly it was far less common, you know, even 10 years ago, and certainly 20 or 30 years ago. But nowadays, you know, you can find, as long as you've got a computer, you know, and a phone, a lot of jobs, you know, unless it's sort of a manual type job, that's really all you need. So I think that sort of stigma of, oh, they work at home, what's wrong with them, you know, has gone away a bit now.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, a lot of people just, they don't get that you have regular work hours because you do work at home, and so they kind of
Well, a lot of
presume,
it is, you know,
I guess, to try to occupy your time or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, a lot of my friends who are authors, you know, they don't like regular hours. A lot of authors I know, they love to prefer to work at night. You know, they like to sort of crank it out from like 7 at night till 3 or 4 in the morning. You know, I don't like that. I like to sort of get up and, you know, get up early and work, and then play afterwards. You know, I'm not one of those that likes to, you know, I like nighttime for having a good time, not for working, you know, so I like to keep it regular.
Right. Well, that makes absolute sense. And I think we had a couple more questions. I'll see if I can snag them here. Let's see. You've lived in both England and the U.S. Have you noticed any difference in openness? I think they're talking in terms of witnesses and reports about the various things that you write about.
I'd probably say it's broadly similar. I mean, I think military people, their openness or willingness, I should say, to talk and reluctance is probably balanced in the U.K. and the U.S. and probably everywhere, you know. It's like, you know, military agencies and intelligence agencies all across the world all revolve around secrecy, you know, and I think anybody who's experienced anything in the military will know that, whichever country it is, you know, you're basically, it's understood that you won't talk about sensitive things. So I think it's just the same. That's the same anywhere. And I think the worry about ridicule is probably pretty much the same. You know, that people always wonder, well, what's somebody going to say if I said I've seen a UFO? And I understand that. You know, I understand the stigma. I wish the stigma wasn't there, but I understand if we look at it realistically, a lot of people, you know, do still view it as, oh, if somebody's seen a UFO, they're a bit odd. You know, that attitude still exists. But I think it's better than it was. You know, 20 years ago, the media were really sort of, you know, just would ridicule the subject. And I think today, particularly, you know, shows on stuff like the History Channel, Discovery, a lot of these shows take the subjects far more seriously, or in some cases very seriously, you know, than they did 20 years ago. So in that respect, you know, I think things are changing for the better, but I think it's sort of a slow process, and it's reflected pretty much, you know, all around the world, really.
Uh-huh. Well, that kind of makes sense. And then I have another question from the Virtual Auditorium. They want to, it's actually sort of a request, they want to hear more about bases on the moon.
They want to, what, sorry?
They want to hear more about bases on the moon.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually a chapter I've got in the Keep Out book, because, you know, the book is a study of secret installations, and you would imagine that at the very least, you know, at least these places are going to be on Earth. You know, I mean, where else would they be? Well, one of the
things. Well, one on the moon's got to be pretty secret, because it's not like you can do a drive-by.
Well, no, that's right. That's right. But there are rumors about sort of secret clandestine space programs that sort of run alongside NASA, you know, but that aren't actually part of NASA. You know, they could be some sort of classified military space program. Now, what we know in terms of whistleblower stories and on the record accounts from military personnel is a number of people have come forward talking about their knowledge of seeing classified NASA photographs seeming to show some sort of large, intelligently constructed installation on the moon. And some people talked about the far side of the moon, you know, looking like some huge equivalent of like a North Pole outpost or something like that, but massive in scale. Now, of course, you know, the first thought is that, well, if this is some sort of futuristic installation built on the moon, and some people were talking about seeing this back in the 60s or hearing about these photographs, you would have to imagine that, well, this has got to be the work of aliens, because in 65, when some of these stories were circulating, you know, this was 4 years still before Neil Armstrong even landed on the moon, so how could it be anything of ours? Now, one of the people who spoke out about this was a retired U.S. Air Force guy named Carl Wolf. And in 1965, Carl Wolf was working at Langley on a NASA program, and he was told by one of the that NASA had got photographs showing some sort of installation on the far side of the moon. And, of course, Carl Wolf realized this was sort of a security issue, and the pair basically broke off the conversation. But he never forgot about it and, you know, thought, wow, this somebody has built a base on the moon. And, you know, the inference is that it's aliens. But one of the interesting things I found when doing the research for the book is that as far back as the late 1950s, the U.S. Army had a program, a secret program, to secretly build a base on the moon. And this project was known as Project Horizon. And if you Google Project Horizon plus Moon, you'll find the documents, some of the documents, which are now available from government websites. And basically, the plan was, bear in mind this is the height of the Cold War, the late 50s, the plan was to build basically like a military base on the moon where it would be sort of protected by nuclear weapons. And the idea was that, say, in a hypothetical scenario, there was a war between, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union. And if in a worst-case scenario the Soviets got their missiles off first and took out a lot of the United States before they had a chance to respond, the idea was, well, there's no way the Russian missiles could reach the moon, but America could have a whole fleet of missiles stationed on the moon that could be directed down to the Soviet Union. You know, they would go from the moon and enter the Earth's orbit and then spiral onto Russia. So in other words, the idea of the military had was to build this secret base and militarize the moon. It wasn't so much for, like, scientific exploration. Now, what was interesting is that the official story is that the Army cancelled the program for two reasons. One, lack of funds, and the other one, lack of adequate technology to build this base back at the, in that time. But what's interesting is that the Project Horizon plan was to have the first stages of the base up and running by 1965. That was their goal. And it's interesting that 1965 was the same year that Carl Wolf heard about these photographs of some sort of base on the moon. You know, you have to wonder, is there a tie-in? And, you know, people have speculated, particularly with the way in which NASA's really now downsizing, you know, and for America to get its astronauts into space today, it literally has to ask the Russians, you know, to sort of piggyback them up into space, you know, because we don't have a manned space program anymore. So, you know, people said, well, that's just ridiculous to go from having sort of, you know, putting the first people on the moon, having a space shuttle, to go to nothing. And some researchers think that isn't what's happened. They think that's the cover story, and that the real further manned missions, etc., actually fall under the control of the military, not NASA. You know, so you know, the idea is there's a secret space program going on.
Ah, yeah. Did you find a lot of evidence to support the concept of a secret space?
Well, I mean, there are a few things, you know, where, for example, we know, I mean, one of the things we know for sure, this isn't sort of directly related to a secret space program, but a lot of people don't realize that many of the space shuttle missions in the 1980s and 90s weren't space exploration missions. They're actually classified missions undertaken in conjunction with the Department of Defense, where the astronauts, you know, they weren't launching, you know, probes to check out the atmosphere of, you know, Jupiter or somewhere. What they were doing, they were launching spy satellites to the Department of Defense. So, you know, in that sense, we know that even NASA has been steeped in secrecy as it relates to some of its space programs. Now, there are other stories, you know, people talking about the military developing sort of fantastic UFO-like craft, and one of these supposedly called Aurora, which is described as a hypersonic-type aircraft, like one of these so-called huge flying triangle type aircraft that people have seen. But one of the theories is that it can actually leave the Earth's atmosphere as well, you know, and be sort of, you know, essentially operate as an aircraft and a spacecraft. You know, what we're missing, unfortunately, right now is, you know, the definitive smoking gun. But we do have a lot of testimony from credible people saying, you know, that the face of NASA is the truthful face of NASA, but there's somebody else doing similar things behind the scenes whose face we're not seeing at all. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's that's something that crops up a lot, like in internet rumors and whatnot, too. And speaking of internet rumors, over the past month or so, there's been a lot of these rumors of these strange noises coming from the earth or the sky in various points in the United States. And then somebody said, oh, these rumors actually originated in Eastern Europe and traced them back to a preacher that now lives, I think it was like Kentucky or Tennessee, it's one of those states in that general area, and that was originally from the same country in Eastern Europe, and that it was all just a big hoax. And then that report sort of disappeared, and more reports of these strange noises are reappearing. You know, has this been something that's come to your attention?
Well, I know these stories. I've seen the footage, you know, on YouTube and places like that. And some of these sounds, they do kind of sound weird, you know, a bit ominous and eerie almost. You know, very weird noises and sounds. I've never actually investigated these new ones, primarily because I know there's a lot of sort of internet chatter about it and a lot of people who are already researching them. So, you know, the fact that they're doing that is good. The closest I've come is to investigate things like in Taos in New Mexico, there was this strange thing that goes back to the 80s known as the Taos hum, where people heard this sort of, New Mexico in the town of Taos, heard this sort of deep, resonating, weird humming sound, you know, that would sort of make them feel sick and ill, and it seems to be coming from underground. And I've investigated a number of these type of stories of sounds like deep humming noises that, you know, seem to have the ability to affect and the human nervous system, you know, sort of induce nausea and things like this. And, you know, one of the theories is that these Huns are actually sort of the outgrowth, if you like, of huge underground installations, you know, that what we're hearing are sort of is evidence of the sort of technology at work under there to keep these places up and running. So that's about the closest I've come to it. But, you know, I've followed this story in the last few weeks and months, but I haven't personally investigated it, no.
Yeah. Well, like in Taos, the Taos Hum, which, you know, anybody who's, you know, heard of it has heard, you know, some people hear it, some people don't.
Yeah.
I've been to Taos. My great-grandmother taught school in Taos for a number of years. Taos is also located right along a fault line because the Rio Grande Gorge is also a fault line. And there's, you know, obviously some geological activity going on there because they've got hot springs and whatnot going on there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any association with, you know, in Taos's case, with the Hum, with normal geological activity that you'd find in an area that's active?
I mean, there's a lot of stories from New Mexico about, you know, not necessarily geographical, you know, geological faults, but, you know, underground installations. There's, you know, four or five places that have been put forward, particularly in northern New Mexico, you know, where Taos is, about the idea about massive caverns having been sort of converted into fortified underground installations. So there was a lot of weird earthquake activity in and around the Dulce area in the mid-1960s. And, of course, Dulce's been, you know, sort of linked with stories of an underground base, or actually inside the mountain there, which is called Archuleta Mesa. So, you know, whether or not they're actual, like, fault lines, or could we be seeing evidence of massive cavernous areas where, you know, it sort of destabilized the ground to an extent purely because, you know, it's so hollow in certain places. You know, I think there's a lot of scope for research in those areas that hasn't been done. You know, a lot of people found fragments of some stories that, you know, I think sort of deserve further study.
Well, I know there's always been suggestions that the entire southwestern United States has these massive underground tunnels, network of tunnels. I'm not sure who supposedly dug them or how old they're supposed to be, but I know that I've often heard people reference, I know there is areas where there's lots of sandstone or limestone caves and phenomena known as the blowholes, where holes in the ground have cold air coming up out of them, which means, you know, air goes in somewhere, and so forth and so on. So, you know, you can't help but, I guess, wonder. And sometimes, you know, maybe it is natural phenomena that gives rise to these stories of secret underground facilities, or makes the stories even bigger. If you have something, some natural feature that's located, you know, 100 miles or 200 miles from a suspected underground base, you know, you could make that underground base look a lot larger.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people who's done a lot of research into these sort of areas, particularly, you know, with the feasibility of creating these things, is Richard Soda, who has written a number of good books on underground and undersea bases. You know, and the good thing about Richard's work is that he doesn't just focus on witness testimony. One of the things he did was to sort of really pursue things through the Freedom of Information Act and find, you know, massive amounts of files talking about military applications for sort of hugely advanced tunnel boring devices, you know, that can tunnel at incredible speeds deep underground, you know, just hollow out whole areas in weeks. And, you know, it sounds like science fiction until you realize you read, you know, previously classified government files that are now in the public domain. It sort of really opens your eyes to, wow, you know, if this technology was being developed 40 years ago, you know, what sort of underground tunneling and burrowing devices have we got, you know, 40 years later? So.
Well, you know, and too, there, you know, talking about science fiction and truth being stranger than fiction sometimes, there has been a story that's cropped up about a supposed gunfight, I believe it occurred in the Dulce area, between humans and aliens. Was this something that you, in your research, also came across?
Yeah, I've dug into the Dulcie story for people who aren't aware of it. It's basically, Dulcie is a town, little town in northern New Mexico, which is dominated by this huge mountain, or a mesa, called Archuleta Mesa. And going back to the 1970s, there's been a lot of stories about supposedly some sort of fortified installation buried deep inside the mesa. But the story is that it doesn't fall under the control of the U.S. government, but it falls under the control of hostile aliens, and the government's been sort of forcibly removed and is actually frightened to sort of even go back or even try to go back. And there are a lot of weird, controversial stories about supposedly experimentation and taken on captured humans and all sorts of weird stuff. You know, a lot of people just roll their eyes at this, but what for me keeps the Dulcie story one of great interest is the fact that we can verifiably prove there has been a lot of weird activity in Dulcie. For example, back in 1967, a lot of people don't realize this, but only 12 miles from Dulcie, the government actually exploded underground a small kiloton yield nuclear device. And this is part of a program called Operation Gas Buggy. The plan was to use the detonation to release natural gas, which could then be used, you know, as a form of energy. The unofficial story is the government was panicked by this Dulcie base and the aliens in control of it, and so tried to destroy it with this atomic device. You know, a lot of people think, well, there's no way the government would have, you know, deployed thousands of feet underground a nuclear device and exploded it in 1967. But none of the files are on file now, on record. You can read them on the internet. The Department of Energy has declassified them. It's forbidden, interestingly enough, today to dig in the area. And the Department of Energy says, well, you know, we don't want anybody radioactive materials. On the other hand, it would be a great diversion story if you wanted people not to dig because you're fearful they'd find evidence of the underground base. Now, on top of that, the FBI have declassified a stash of files running into hundreds of pages of weird cattle mutilations in the area in the 1970s, which the FBI officially studied. So, you know, that's sort of the background, but this firefight story that you're talking about supposedly occurred out at Dulcie in 1979, and the story was that, you know, as I said, the scenario is that the government has sort of lost control of the base, you know, and are fearful of going back. And the story is that they kind of sent in like a Delta Force team to try and reclaim it, and which ended disastrously, you know, with the military just being wiped out and forced to retreat and never go back, you know. So that's the story. And, I mean, a number of people have told it. A number of people have said they read documents about it. Interestingly, Bob Lazar from Area 51 said that he read documents about that, but he said the place was Area 51, not Dulcie. So, you know, we have to wonder if parts of the story are spurious and have been spread to confuse what might have been some real weird confrontation. But it's certainly one of these areas that, you know, is an integral part of the story if we can prove it. And I think it's either this year or certainly early next year, a sci-fi movie is being made about the Dulcie story. It's called Top Secret Umbra. And if you Google that plus Dulcie, you should find information that tells you when the film's coming out. You know, it'd be like I don't know if it's made for TV or for the, you know, for the cinema, but it's like a sci-fi movie about the Dulcie story.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. Oftentimes, it seems as though fiction is used to make the truth a little less horrifying.
Yeah,
I find that a little interesting, but yeah, you know, it does seem like fiction does smooth over the path for future truth.
Well, yeah, and I think some people, you know, fiction can be a good way of getting information over to people without realizing they're actually being told a truth. You know, sometimes governments sort of test the waters of wanting to reveal something, and they encourage maybe somebody to reveal it in a fictional format and see what the response is. You know, I think, and that can apply to the UFO subject. It's kind of like a good psychological tool. If you have a big secret and you're wondering whether to release it, well, how about we release it in the form of, you know, encourage somebody or sponsor them to write a novel about it and see what the response is, and then maybe we'll go a step further and just test the public reaction, or kind of prepare and acclimatize people to some by putting it out in popular culture And then if you release it, it makes it easier when everybody's sort of more already comfortable with it.
Right. Sometimes I think it's a way of testing the waters for the newest fiction, too. You know, we come up with these explanations for things, you know, years after the fact, and, you know, periodically the old explanation, I guess, sort of runs out of gas. So they need a new one. And so, fiction can be used to test those out. You know, another question that, you know, a lot of people have had is about the United States' Fort Detrick, the post-9/11 anthrax attack.
Mm.
War on Terror and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah.
War on Terror has been on everybody's mind here lately as we go into an election year. You know, how do all these bases even tie in with the War on Terror?
Well, you know, I mean, I think, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that in terms of, you know, sort of post-9/11, I mean, agencies all around the world, you know, sort of fortified their installations, you know. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's kind of like during the Second World War, you know, in London, you know, where I'm originally from, England. You know, the government, when the Germans were bombing England on a nightly basis, you know, they moved actually part of the government down into the London Underground, into the old tube stations, into some of the old closed-off tunnels, and reconverted them into sort of secret bunker areas where the government could sort of continue work while, you know, the ground upstairs, if you like, was being bombed nightly. So I think, you know, that we're seeing certainly to a degree that occurring in, you know, today's world where existing bunkers and classified installations are being added to and extensively sort of far more added to underground as well, you know, developing large bunkers and vaults and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, we're seeing that certainly all around the world. You know, it's not just something affecting one nation. And, you know, I think that'll continue. You know, the sheer state of what the world's in now, you know, I expect to fully see more and more sort of off-limits installations constructed rather than less, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, in a lot of ways, I suppose these underground bunkers make a lot of sense. You know, we've long heard periodically about the massive bunkers used for the federal government, for the president and vice president and whatnot, and so forth and so on. But most of us really don't think about biowarfare in terms of things going on right here in the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's actually a couple of installations that get involved in this. One, Fort Detrick in Maryland, and the other one, the Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. And certainly the Dugway Proving Ground is kind of a little bit like Area 51 in the sense that it's out in the desert. You know, it's sort of a fortified, well-guarded installation, you know, significantly far enough away from most of civilization, you know, for most people not to even be able to access it. And both Fort Detrick and the Dugway Proving Ground get involved in undertaking defensive research to sort of counterattack, you know, any sort of assault on the United States using biological weapons. You know, in the worst case scenario, some crazy person, foreign leader, whoever, you know, tries to unleash some sort of deadly virus on the United States. People at Fort Detrick and the Dugway Proving Ground, these are the people who sort of try and develop antidotes and countermeasures, you know, to exotic viruses that could sort of spiral out of control and just, you know, decimate populations. So, you know, a lot of work has been done in these areas, and of course, you know, a lot of these viruses have to be handled very, very carefully, you know, because, you know, releasing or inadvertently releasing some of these things into the public domain, you know, could be disastrous if we don't have viable antidotes for them. And one of the distant stories about Fort Detrick and also the Dugway Proving Ground is that they, at various points in their history, have stored alien bodies there, and that one of the darker rumors is that the autopsies of aliens has actually sort of derived or uncovered sort of the ultimate bioweapon in the form of an alien virus against which, you know, the human immune system would have no immunity. You know, I mean, we have enough problems at times fighting off terrestrial viruses, never mind having to sort of combat an extraterrestrial one. But of course, you know, the big question is, well, how do you use an extraterrestrial virus on your enemy when they're human without wiping yourself out as well, because you're also human? So I think, you know, if there is any viable truth to these stories, then this weapon, if that's what you want to call it, hasn't been used, because I don't think that even if it exists, there isn't a viable antidote to prevent it just spiraling out of control and taking everybody out, which would be, you know, would be pointless. That would just sort of destroy the point of what somebody might be trying to achieve. So.
Right. I mean, they would have to have a antidote or a vaccine of some kind to use on their own, or, be kind of pointless.
Yeah. Well, that's what Fort Detrick and Dugway do. They try and provide vaccines for, you know, sort of deadly viruses that an enemy nation might unleash or thinking about unleashing, and just preparing for the worst case scenario, but hoping it doesn't happen. But, you know, coming up with viable antidotes and vaccines and keeping them, you know, in storage, etc., if they're needed.
Mm-hmm. Now, another area that a lot of people don't think of in terms of secrets and off-limits mm-hmm. areas is the Vatican.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Vatican, I think sometimes at least people do think it, but then on the other hand, at other times, you know, we always kind of think of, I think, like military installations, you know, it's the military is hiding things. You don't necessarily always think it's sort of the Catholic Church. But there's actually a very interesting story. It goes back to the Second World War. And during the Second World War, you know, the Nazis, you know, they took on America, Britain, Russia, a great deal more, you know, of Europe, Australia, and they were just one nation. And a lot of people have said, well, you know, how did the Nazis, just one country, Germany, take on the entire world and actually almost win? And one of the reasons was, you know, they developed massive alternative means of funding. And to get this funding, the Nazis set up a puppet outfit in Croatia called the Ustashi. Basically, the Ustashi was a group whose end goal was to sort of plunder and steal and grab by any means possible ancient artifacts and priceless items like gold and jewels and, you know, ancient treasures, ancient paintings and religious artifacts, and basically, you know, put them on the black market and earn money for the Nazis, which could then be channeled into, you know, the Nazi war machine. And mm-hmm. we know that, I mean, in terms of, the amount of money we're talking about, I mean, in terms of just gold alone, during the Second World War, at one point, the Nazis had actually got their hands on, in today's money, $2.6 billion in gold that went to fund the Nazis. And that was just gold, you know, never mind everything else. Now, what happened was that when the Nazis actually were facing defeat in 1945, the Ustashi began to sort of spiral and collapse, and various people in the group, sort of seeing that the end was near, basically grabbed what they could and, you know, just vanished into the wilderness or the woods or whatever, you know, with a stash of treasure and hoping to sort of just basically make a deal with who was going to be the next big, you know, people in town or whatever. And various agencies around the world began looking into all this hidden treasure and trying to find it. And one of them was the U.S. Treasury Department. And in 1946, Waters, which is in Washington, D.C., received a top-secret communication from one of their staff, from a man named Emerson Bigelow, who was an agent of the Treasury. And Bigelow had been looking into a lot of sort of disturbing stories about how supposedly some of these Ustashi guys who worked for the Nazis had done deals with the Vatican and with various other Italian religious figures, etc., and people in the government, basically where they would give safe haven to the Nazi people and the Ustashi in return for sort of priceless artifacts, you know, which would help fund the Vatican and the Italian economy. And the story that Emerson Bigelow uncovered, which he detailed extensively, he dug into this very, very deeply, was that there were massive vaults deep below the Vatican where, like, priceless ancient gold and artifacts literally going back, you know, to sort of, you know, kind of Indiana Jones type stories, almost like, and that supposedly all these priceless artifacts were hidden deep below the Vatican, and even though these stories have long since been denied, you know, we still get people coming forward talking about not just the recognized vaults beneath the Vatican, which do exist, but deeper vaults where all these sort of priceless treasures are stored away and, you know, in crates, kind of like the final scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where there's all this priceless, mysterious material and priceless treasures just hidden away from prying eyes. And that's the story that has sort of been laid feet to the Vatican, that, you know, they're doing something similar.
Yeah, you know, the Catholic Church has been accused of all sorts of dastardly deeds over the last few years, and that is one that ranks high on many groups' lists of, you know, you might say their sins, is the fact that they have taken a lot of ancient treasures from various ethnic groups around the world. This is separate and aside from the Nazi connection, which, you know, as somebody who's not like a history major or anything, I really wasn't aware of the strong connections between the Nazi Party and the Vatican of today.
Well, I mean, a lot of nations. Yeah, go on. Sorry.
I didn't know. I never thought about it, I guess.
Well, I mean, a lot of nations at the end of the Second World War, you know, scrambled to grab what was left of the Nazi regime. For example, a lot of Nazi scientists went to Russia to work, some went to England, and hundreds went to work at the White Sands Proving Ground, now the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. And this was under a program called Operation Paperclip. And one of those who was brought over was Wernher von Braun. Wernher von Braun worked for the Nazis under Hitler and designed like the V-1 and V-2 rocket that bombed London. You know, they were these huge rockets that would fly from Germany and just, you know, destroy old buildings. Von Braun was brought to the U.S. and became, you know, one of the leading figures in NASA. And he was, you know, he's one of Hitler's minions bombing London in the war. So in other words, a lot of the, you know, what went on in the war was actually forgotten or pushed under the table, you know, when the war ended. One of the reasons being that although, you know, the Nazis were terrible people and did, you know, terrible things, their scientists were far in advance of what anybody else is in the world. You know, they had plans for, even in the Second World War, for spacecraft. They had plans to build rockets in 1944 that could reach New York from Germany. You know, like intercontinental ballistic missiles. Hitler actually had plans to build an atomic weapon to destroy New York and fly it, you know, from Berlin in Germany, which in 1944 was like science fiction. You know, it was just no one else could achieve anything. So, you know, it's a good thing the Nazis were defeated. But in the sort of the cold light of day, there was also this realization that, well, we've got to get our hands on their technology before the Russians do, and they were thinking exactly the same. And so that, you know, there was this battle on to just grab, when Germany collapsed, you know, everybody and his brother invaded Germany and sort of set up camp and tried to grab as many scientists and as many, you know, fact installations as they could and just grab whatever was in there. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes for some interesting history behind a lot of what's going on today. Now, as far as, you know, we're in 2012, the year everything's supposed to come to an end. How does that Mayan prophecy, or does it even tie into any of this? And we've only got a couple of minutes, so if you don't have time to answer the question all the way, we'll just continue with that after the break.
All righty. Well, yeah, I mean, I'll start and then just sort of say, shut up, Nick, we're going to break.
All right.
And, but, yeah, I mean, the whole 2012 thing, you know, is interesting because, you know, excuse me, we're in 2012 now. You know, if anything's going to happen in December, it's not like we've got long to find out.
Right.
A lot of talk being, you know, bandied around and told about, you know, what's going to happen in December. Well, you know, contrary to popular belief, you know, the Mayan prophecies don't actually forecast, you know, tsunamis and earthquakes and comets hitting the planet and, you know, the planet plot spiraling down into destruction. What they actually say is that December the 21st, 2012, will mark the end of the latest Earth cycle. The Mayans believe that, you know, the human race developed in different cycles, and in some cases, you know, if the first cycle wasn't a good one, it would start over. But other, you know, they also believed in the idea that the cycle could also be like a spiritual change, you know, sort of an evolutionary shift in the mindset of the population. You know, the cycle, we were intended to learn something, not necessarily be punished, you know, by some supernatural force or whatever. So, you know, that's the most emotive question, is what does that term cycle mean as it applies to 2012? Now, regardless of what it means or it doesn't mean, and regardless of the fact that it won't be long before we find out, it is a fact that in the last few years, governments around the world have been fortifying and, you know, as I said, alluded to earlier, extending a lot of their underground installations. And within a lot of the 2012 conspiracy research fields and discussion groups, there's a lot of talk about, are there people in governments who know that something is looming on the horizon for December? And so these government agencies are now planning for the worst-case scenario in the event it happens, and that what we're seeing is not sort of an adding to the construction of these places because of the war on terror or 9/11 or fears of dirty bombs, but fear of the ancient prophecies coming true. And, you know, that's sort of what's prompted these ideas that, you know, there's something more going on behind governments, you know, whether it's Russia, China, Britain,
America. Well, hold your thought right there, Nick.
Okay.
Hold your thought. Hold there. Folks, the first half of the Dawn Shades has come to an end. While we're gone, go ahead, check our website, www.exogenynetwork.com, and let us know what you think. We'll be back in just a few minutes with our guest, Nick Redfern, and more about 2012.
Your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we're having a great conversation with Nick Redfern about his book, Keep Out. We're also ready to take calls from the audience, so if you want to call in, just dial 504-273-7379. Now, Nick, we were talking about 2012 and its connection with the secret bases and all those fortifications that are supposed to have been going on. You want to tell us some more about it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, these stories that are sort of circulated are that there are certain people in government that know something or suspect or worry that something, you know, is going to happen in December, and they're planning for the worst-case scenario but hoping for the best-case scenario. Now, a number of countries around the world have sort of been pointed out as areas of key interest to people who are in this sort of 2012 conspiracy has been of particular interest, one of them being Norway. For example, as far back as 1984, Norway had something on the island of Spitsbergen, which is an island off the coast of Norway. As far back as 84, there was a thing called Norway's Nordic Gene Bank, which is basically like a vaulted area stored in an old coal mine on Spitsbergen. But today, the situation is sort of far more ambitious. And today, instead of having just this sort of old coal mine, you know, where a few things were stored, etc., they have something called the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. And this falls under the auspices of something called the Nordic Genetic Resource Center. And it basically extends nearly 400 feet into and under a mountain on the island. And what's interesting is that this global seed vault is actually home to more than 1.5 million types of different seeds, you know, all distinct different seeds, whether plants, flowers, crops, fruit, vegetables, etc., etc. You know, the idea being that in the event of a national emergency, you know, the Norwegian people could sort of start over because they have this massive resource buried deep in the mountain on the island of Spitsbergen. What's interesting, just as an aside, is that there've been long-standing rumors about a UFO crash on Spitsbergen back in 1952, and supposedly one of the stories is that the Norwegians built kind of like an underground installation on the island to house the crashed UFO. Now, whether that's true or not, it's interesting that today it has this huge seed vault with 1.5 million seeds actually buried inside a mountain on the island, you know, where you had the UFO stories years before. So that's one place. Now, Russia, for example, in the last few years, that's been massively extending a number of its underground installations. Two of them actually buried in the Yamato and Kazvinsky Mountains in the Urals. And these are sort of huge fortified installations. The Kazvinsky site, for example, is actually buried inside of a mountain of more than 1,000 feet of granite. And in a national emergency, it can house in excess of 50,000 people. And as far as the Yamato base is concerned, U.S. intelligence operatives have said it's about the size of the Washington, D.C. area inside the Beltway, and it's all buried underground. So, you know, we have places like this. There's one in China called the Sanya Base, which is located off the tip of Hainan Island in the South China Sea. Now, ostensibly, the Chinese say this is like an underground or underwater submarine base. And certainly, you know, there is submarine activity there. But when you find that, you know, there are literally massive tunnels extending far into the mountains and the hills, then it becomes clear that the submarine angle, while not fake, actually only tells a small part of the story. There's also a lot of stories about extensions being made to underground installations in the US. And, you know, a lot of rumors that this is all being done with a time limit in mind. So, you know, it's no sort of wonder that this has been applied to the 2012 stories. And, you know, as I said, the thing we won't have long to do is wait. You know, we're going to find out sooner or later if these stories are going to be vindicated or not.
Yeah, you know, we've got, what, about 10.5 months now? So one way or another, you know, 2012 is coming to a head. We are either going to be ready for whatever comes, or nothing's going to come, and we're going to be all dressed up with nowhere to go.
Well, you know, I always say to people, you know, when it comes to things like prophecies, it's always incredibly difficult to gauge, you know, the nature of the prophecy and what's being said. I mean, it's like Nostradamus. A lot of people sort of write Nostradamus off as a hoaxer. Other people believe him literally and then felt let down, you know, and some of the things he said didn't come true. But the problem is, you know, is it, many of these sort of prophecies and stories are sort of couched in terms that make it very open to question as to what it means, you know, the end of a cycle. You know, if the Mayans had said on December 21st, a comet is going to run into the planet, or, you know, an earthquake's going to break out in China, which is going to spiral here, there, and everywhere. You know, they didn't say that. They just said it marks the end of the next cycle. And, of course, you know, a lot of people said, well, you know, are the calendars actually correct? Is the date of December the 21st actually the correct date? You know, so that leaves the whole thing open to even more question as well. So, you know, all we can do is wait and see, you know, that nothing goes wrong. So.
Yeah. How about Nick Redfern personally? Are you anticipating the end of the world in December?
What did you say?
I said Nick Redfern personally, you personally. Are you expecting the end of the world
in
December?
Oh, I'm expecting it. No, I'm not. I mean, you know, I have, not just for being optimistic that nothing's going to happen, but I mean, if you look at most prophecies throughout history, you know, Nostradamus said there was going to be this huge disaster in 1999. You know, it didn't happen. Nobody prophesied 9/11. You know, I'm not a big fan of prophecies because, you know, where was, say, the prophecies about the Internet? Most people didn't foresee the Internet ever happening, but it came out of nowhere and changed the planet. You know, and mm-hmm. 9/11, probably the most world-changing event. Nobody prophesied that. So, you know, I'm always cautious. I don't necessarily mean that people are lying, but I think a lot of people who prophesize and who have visions of the future, you know, there's always this degree of putting an interpretation on what it means, when it's going to happen, etc. You know, that's not to say people haven't prophesied events that haven't come true. I think we've all occasionally had weird events where, you know, you have a dream about a friend you haven't seen in 10 years, and then they phone you the next day. You know, that's kind of like some sort of like a prophecy. So I don't dispute this happens, but I think the challenge is to try and figure out the fragmentary way in which prophecies suddenly appear to the person, and then how you translate that into what's going to happen in the real world. And I think that's sometimes where prophecies look like they fail, because it's the interpretation of the prophecy that's been wrongly interpreted, not the fact that something may not happen. So I think, you know, I don't think the world's going to end. I think we're probably going to wake up on December 22nd, all be well, and we're opening our Christmas presents on December the 25th. I hope.
Yeah, I'm actually planning a New Year's Eve party that December 31st. So,
yeah,
obviously,
in case,
I'm not anticipating it.
No, we should all enjoy ourselves leading up to it, just in case. And then, if nothing goes wrong, well, at least we had a good excuse for enjoying ourselves.
Right. Well, we should do that anyhow. Actually,
yeah, exactly. We should do that. We shouldn't need an excuse that the world's going to end to have a good time. So, it just means we have a better time. That's all.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole 2012 thing, and, you know, you're talking about it open for interpretation. You know, even the sections of the Bible that predict the coming of Christ, when I read it, I'm like, yes, that's what it was supposed to mean. I wouldn't do it.
Well, no, I mean, you know, it's a lot of these old books, you know, they're taken, you know, no pun intended, but they're taken as gospel. You know, they're not open to interpretation. But clearly, you know, a lot of religious accounts, biblical accounts are, you know, they're like parables. You know, they're sort of teaching people ways to live, etc., rather than, you know, a literal historical account. And I think, you know, you can apply that to anything, any story that occurred before, you know, recorded history in terms of as we know it today, where it's verifiable and we can go back and see film footage and listen to radio shows of something that happened 80 years ago or whatever. You know, we're still... Mm. I mean, you go back into the United States more than a few hundred years, you know, and you say to somebody, what was happening in where Utah is today in the 1300s? How many people would know? You know, or what was happening in California in, say, 700 AD? You know, mm-hmm. It's like, it's a mystery because the United States as a nation didn't exist then. So in other words, trying to determine much about the past just from relying on, you know, stories passed down through generations isn't necessarily the most reliable approach to take, I think. I'm sure a lot of people won't agree with me.
You know,
sure,
if you go with oral history, okay?
Yeah,
I had
oral
history for my family.
Yeah.
I went to do genealogy research, and guess what? Not one of the stories has panned out.
Mm-hmm.
Not one. And this is from, you know, multiple families, you know, ultimately marrying each other and resulting in me. But this is multiple families, oral histories. Not one has been correct. And you kind of, you can't help but scratch your head and go, you know, and this is stuff that's supposed to be less than 200 years old. Who wants to rely on anything any older than that?
Well, that's right. The problem is, though, that people do. You know, it's kind of like the Mayan prophecies are, you know, sort of for many people, they're sort of cast in stone, literally, you know. But my view is, how can they be? It doesn't mean something significant won't happen, but it means that if we look at all the other prophecies that have been forecast, you know, like the whole, you know, thing with the, you know, the UFO cult where they all committed suicide, Heaven's Gate. There was all these stories about, you know, catastrophes and planets coming towards the Earth and comets and all sorts of things, hail bop, all this. None of that panned out, you know, but people took their own lives because they were so convinced it was going to happen. Recently
we had Harold Camping predicting the end of the world and the rapture.
Yeah, that's right. And then he had the...
Nothing happened.
Basically say he got it wrong, you know, and if you got it wrong once, you can get it wrong again, and, you know, that's why I don't dispute that people have weird experiences, you know, because I've experienced this where, you know, people have sort of like deja vu, which is kind of like a time loop situation, if you like, and other people have, you know, as I said, that classic thing of not suddenly thinking of somebody you haven't thought of for 30 years, and then they call. That's almost like forecasting or prophesizing and getting them into your mind, if you like. So things like that do happen, but I think the challenge is to interpreting and understanding what's going on and not making the big mistake of, you know, loudly proclaiming that it means this or that, you know.
Right, I always tell people, don't take 2 + 2 and make it into 22. You know, and that happens. You know, I think my favorite cartoon about the whole 2012 thing is, you know, this it's a cartoon showing two cartoon Mayan characters and the stone being carved, and they ran out of room on the stone, and, you know, one says, oh, just leave it like that. They'll wonder what happens. You know, and that's kind of, you know, you can't help but going, well, what if they did just run out of space, you know? There was supposed to be another stone, and, you know, here comes Cortez or whoever was the one that arrived there. I forget now. My history is kind of failing me. But whoever the conqueror was that arrived at that particular time, and in the stone carving, you know, and, yeah, that's all over with.
Yeah. Now, what I would say, though, is that there's absolutely no doubt that people like the Mayan, you know, they were brilliant people. And there's also no doubt that if you go back into most ancient cultures, they had far more of an understanding of, you know, many areas that we just don't give them credit for today. You know, astronomy, for example, you know, the environment. They seem to have like a closer affinity and understanding of the environment itself, of nature, the interaction between the human race and sort of nature forces and things like this. and they seem to have a sort of a deep spiritual affinity. I don't necessarily, when I say spiritual affinity, mean to any particular religion, but they seem to have an affinity with nature itself, with the sort of life force of the planet. You know, you hear a lot of these stories about, you know, ancient stone circles sort of constructed with levitation and things like this, you know, rather than just rollers and, you know, ropes and things. And you have to wonder if ancient man, in some respects, did know far more about sort of very weird and alternative sciences and ancient knowledge that we've just lost. And I think there's good evidence that that is the case. Now, you know, maybe that ties in with prophecy. You know, maybe there are parts of the human brain that we've, or the mind we've forgotten about, that remain untapped. You know, maybe they really knew something and they could tap into, you know, sort of future. I mean, who knows? You know, it's an open area, I think. But, you know, I think, again, the issue of forecasting specific dates, you know, across thousands of years, when calendars change and when, you know, somebody's year is different to somebody else's year, etc., and something was translated, you know, 20 years later and they get the dates wrong in the translation. When all these sort of factors come into play, it can be incredibly difficult in really trying to date anything that was forecast thousands of years ago.
Yes, that's true. Do you ever sat and wondered, you know, gee, what would it be like to have a window where I could just look back in time and see what they were really doing?
Oh, yeah, I think we get a lot of surprises, you know. I mean, I'd defy anybody today to sort of go out and build a pyramid or Stonehenge in the fashion that the people were supposed to build them. You know, it's like people just say, oh, well, it was just ropes and rollers, you know. Well, I'd like to see somebody build, you know, move a 40-ton rock with ropes and rollers, you know, across hills and, you know, sort of angled landscapes, etc., and then stand them upright and then load another stone on top of that, which happens to be 20 feet in the air, you know, the size of a truck or whatever. You know, it's just like, oh, well, they use rollers, you know, which means nothing, just nonsense, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to have that chore. And, you know, how many hundreds of people did they have to devote to the task? You know,
yeah,
do they really have that kind of a population?
Yeah, and you know, you can actually go back. I mean, this is an area that sort of deeply interests me. You can go back in all these ancient legends of stone circles and huge, massive structures, you know, made out of gigantic stones. Pretty much every nation on the planet has a legend or rumor that the stones were moved by what they describe as, like, you know, some sort of magic. You know, they would magically lift into the air, which sounds, as some people believe, you know, some sort of anti-gravity technology, or so other people believe, like a sonic acoustic technology, like using acoustics as like a directed energy to lift massive blocks. And I actually don't rule that out. I mean, I've written about this for my next book, which comes out in the summer, called The Pyramids and the Pentagon, about how the government secretly in the 50s and 60s spent a lot of time researching the lives and work of people who were following these stories, you know, that the ancients supposedly possessed some sort of, in simplistic terms, like anti-gravity technology and things like that.
Yeah, you know, the whole idea of those stones being moved by ropes and rollers and being dragged and pushed and pulled, and, you know, I find it mind-boggling. Anybody who has had to move any kind of rock at all would find it mind-boggling.
I mean, you imagine, you bring your moving house, you know, just loading stuff in the back of the truck. That's a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
Imagine you've got to build Stonehenge or the pyramids, you know.
No, thank you. You know, that's an immense amount of work, you know. And to think that they did it for little to no reason is preposterous, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about window areas and going back and sort of seeing into the past, I think we would be, our jaws would probably hit the floor in shock at the things that ancient man did know and believed in and achieved that, you know, that we've lost. You know, we're maybe more technologically advanced, but I think they were more evolved spiritually in terms of understanding the mysteries of the mind than we are. You know, we see everything in black and white, and, you know, that's just the way we look at it. I think ancient man, for example, had far more of an understanding of psychedelics and how psychedelics can expand the mind. Today, it's all about, oh, that drug's illegal, you're going to be jailed. You know, you're going to be jailed for smoking a plant. You know, ancient man had far more of an understanding of the literal sort of door-opening potentials of entering into altered states, and they understood the importance of altered states in terms of provoking deep thought and, you know, new paradigms and ideas, which often come to people in altered states. You know, today it's been demonized by people who see it as bad, you know. And they're the same people who are popping down 40 antidepressants a day or whatever, you know, to alter their mind. But when it's a plant that does it and you smoke it, oh no, you know, that's evil. You know, that's
that thing.
Yeah, an ancient man, I think, knew far more about this. They recognized the importance of, you know, living with nature and everything that goes along with it. So.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that came up in the virtual auditorium a little bit ago, Montauk Project, whether the Montauk Monster that was found on the beaches recently had something to do with that project way back when.
Well, you know, personally, I mean, the Montauk story is an interesting one. I mean, Montauk Air Force Station, which was originally called Camp Hero, it's located on Long Island in New York. Now, I say is located because it's still there, but it's actually closed down now. And it's actually a state park. As far as it's now called the Camp Hero State Park, and, you know, it's widely open to the general public and has been since 2002. And the old military base is still there. You know, it's just like a closed down ghost town, basically. But the story is that the Montauk Air Force Station, back from the 50s through to the 90s, the story is that it was used for highly advanced alternative technological developments, everything from invisibility to teleportation, even rumors about time travel, all sorts of weird stuff like this. And the story supposedly goes back to the famous Philadelphia experiment of the Second World War, when reportedly the U.S. Navy attempted to make one of its warships invisible to radar and to German magnetic mines. And inadvertently, the technology they used supposedly rendered the warship literally invisible, you know, optically invisible, which actually was never the idea or the plan. You know, it was just it was an unforeseen byproduct because the program went wrong. And there were stories about the ship vanishing, either going invisible or sort of its atoms being scrambled and sort of teleported and then reconfigured again. And a lot of the crew members dying or going mad, and others just vanishing into thin air as if their atoms had just sort of, you know, dissipated into nothingness. And the story is that the U.S. Navy panicked, didn't know what to do with it because they didn't understand the technology, and because the atomic bomb was going to be perceived as the next big weapon to hopefully end the war, the idea was, well, let's put this all on hold for now, let's win the war and come back to it later. And suppose that's what happened in the 50s. People went back and said, hey, you know, let's try and understand what went wrong in Philadelphia and try and fix it and try and develop the technology. And the story is that supposedly sort of secret funding, ironically, secret funding that supposedly came from captured Nazi treasures plundered by Western powers at the end of the Second World War from the Germans, in the same way the Germans had plundered it. The story is Western powers got it from the Germans and then, you know, used this as sort of leverage to get funding to run the Montauk program, where the money wouldn't be sort of overseen by congressional oversight, you know, and the story wouldn't come out. But the stories are that from the 50s onwards, you know, all this sort of research, invisibility, teleportation, etc., was undertaken at Montauk. People just say, well, it's impossible. You know, there's no way the government's ever researched invisibility or teleportation. That's just nonsense. But when we look into it, which is one of the things I did, was not just to look into the Montauk story, but to actually see if the claims of what people were saying about being done at Montauk, if we could prove they were. And what was surprising was that in almost every case, whether the government had achieved it or not, they had tried to develop these technologies. For example, only a few years ago, the Air Force declassified into the public domain a document, a previously secret document, titled the Teleportation Study. And it basically was a detailed study that the Air Force contracted out to determine if teleportation of the type that was sort of very successful in Star Trek, but not so successful in The Fly, could actually work. And although the Air Force said, well, you know, it's not impossible, but the technology seems out of our grasp right now, the important thing is they did investigate it. And during as far back as the Second World War, the military was looking to try and develop invisibility in aircraft. What they were doing, they were sort of using high-powered lights to start with and mirrors and angling them on aircraft to try and reflect the sky. So, you know, an aircraft flying through the sky would just look like blue sky. And that's not literal invisibility, but there are other stories that suggest, you know, they were trying to find ways to bend light so, you know, the light would not reflect, would not see the aircraft because the light would be bent and it would be distorted. It might look a bit like a heat haze or something like that. So in other words, the very stuff that was supposedly going on at Montauk, we can prove has been investigated, which I think, again, like with some of these other bases like Dulce, it leaves the door wide open to the idea that, you know, this really was going on to some degree. But when it comes to the Montauk monster, I think that was more of a normal animal that was decomposing under weird circumstances, and, you know, it occurred at Montauk, and I think it kind of got spiraled out of sort of control as, you know, some sort of weird genetic freak built at, or, you know, bred at the base, but I don't think it actually was, you know.
You think it just was pretty much coincidence in nature?
Yeah, I think it was just, you know, an odd-looking, you know, decomposed animal. You know, you see some animals, they look weird. When the skin starts to go off them, you know, and you just have the bone, you know, it's like human beings, a skull. You know, when it returns to the skull, you know, there's no nose. You've just got these two holes. And that's the same with other animals. You know, when the skin goes away and the muscle goes away, the skull doesn't look anything like the original animal looked like for the most part. So.
Well, even before they get that far on the decomposing, I've seen some things come floating down the river, because I live right on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I've seen some things come down the river. You're like, I wonder what that was.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty nasty looking, whatever it was. You know, especially if we've had an exceptional amount of rain that meant, you know, some areas got flooding, so it picked up whatever was laying dead in the woods. And now it's kind of cruising down the river.
Yeah. But that's not to say, you know, that there haven't been some weird animals. You know, cryptozoology, the study of unknown animals, is actually a bigger interest than UFOs, and there's no doubt that there are a lot of very weird animals out there that science hasn't classified, and also some, I think, that science presumes are extinct and that may not be extinct. You know, so there's no doubt that there are weird creatures.
I've interviewed people about Bigfoot, a number of Bigfoot investigators. The Chupacabra is one that comes up often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll see stories online, and usually mainstream press reports it as a coyote with mange, a hairless dog, you know, whatever. Now, what have you found in terms of Chupacabra?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, we have the sort of the U.S. phenomenon, you know, the sort of Texas Chupacabra, they become known, and there's the Puerto Rican phenomenon where, you know, we get a great deal more reports, certainly the original reports. I'd have been on a number of expeditions to Puerto Rico looking for this creature. And I think, you know, if you're going to write about these things or research them, you know, the internet can be a great resource tool, but there's no sort of excuse to getting out there and looking for these things. And all the various expeditions I've done to Puerto Rico, I've spoke to a lot of retired, for example, police officers, civil defense workers, veterinarians who've examined animals reportedly killed by the creature. Many of these, you know, very, very credible people, you know, who are working in, you know, government, defense world, police, etc., you know, veterinary world. And speaking to these people, and ranchers as well, there's no doubt in my mind that whatever the Chupacabra is, you know, I don't pretend to know what it is, but there's no doubt in my mind that it does exist. Now, on each of the occasions I've been to Puerto Rico, I've come across primarily four stories for what the creature is. One, and this again comes from a wide variation of ranchers, police officers, veterinarians, civil defense people, soldiers. The theories sort of range from an extraterrestrial creature to some sort of unknown animal, possibly like a giant bat, to like a supernatural creature, you know, that's sort of conjured up through paranormal rituals, if you like. And the fourth theory is that some sort of genetic experiment that's escaped from a lab. And, you know, the puzzling thing is that there are actually different aspects of the stories that sort of lend credence to all those theories. For example, some people have talked about the chupacabra having these large bat-like wings, which has sort of given credence to that theory. Other people have noted quite correctly that where the chupacabra has been seen, we get a lot of activity. There are also people on the island of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico actually has a large number of sort of occult-based groups that practice animal sacrifice, where some of their rites and rituals have gone on. People have seen the chupacabra. And there are also a lot of stories about secret installations on the island, supposedly sort of up to their necks in bizarre genetic experimentation and gene splicing and things like that. So, you know, maybe the truth is a combination of one or more theory, but whatever the truth is, there's no doubt in my mind that the chupacabra is a very real and very weird animal.
Is the chupacabra something that's been around for as long as man has been in the Western Hemisphere, or did this crop up, say, in the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, I mean, that's actually a very interesting question, a good question, because, you know, in terms of the name chupacabra, the name actually means goat sucker, and it's a Spanish term that was given because on the island of Puerto Rico, contrary, it has this sort of huge rainforest, the El Yunque rainforest, and sort of sprawling forests and woodland and, you know, lush scenery, etc. There aren't actually any large indigenous wild animals. You know, nothing like big cats or anything like that. No lions, tigers on the island. No giraffes, anything like that. There's just very small animals. And so ranchers and farmers, you know, things like pigs and cows actually imported to the island. There's, you know, nothing even indigenous like that. So a lot of farmers, you know, they own and derive their living from smaller animals like goats. And the chupacabra, as I said, means goat sucker, and the reason it got that name was because many ranchers were reporting their animals killed, and particularly goats, the smaller ones, by these two puncture wounds on the necks, and the animals drained of significant amounts of blood. And the term chupacabra was basically created in the early 1990s. Now, people say, or a lot of skeptics say, well, the creature wasn't seen before then, so because it only surfaced in the 1990s, it has to be like folklore, otherwise, you know, we would have been hearing about these stories years before. But if we look back, we actually find evidence that the stories did exist before. But the big difference was the term chupacabra didn't. For example, there's an area in Puerto Rico called Moca, M-O-C-A, and back in the 80s, there were stories of a creature that became known as the Moca vampire, where people again would wake up in the morning and find their animals drained of blood and puncture wounds on the necks, etc. So the Moca vampire actually sounds like the chupacabra, but with a different name. And we can go back even further to the 50s and 60s to a creature that became known as devil birds on the island. And they sound like some of the chupacabra reports. The Arecibo telescope, which is on Puerto Rico, there are weird stories going back to in the vicinity of the telescope in the 60s about strange animal mutilations and these weird figures that look sort of semi-cloaked, but you could argue that, you know, they look like sort of wraparound wings sort of skulking around in the dead of night. So in other words, I'm not at all sure it is a new phenomenon. I think the name's new, and the way it's entered popular culture is new, but when we go back and you speak to people in some of the little isolated villages, you know, they've been talking about these creatures for decades, but just not by the name of the chupacabra, so.
That's interesting, because I was kind of curious, because if it had just cropped up, say, in the last 20 or 25 years, well, that makes it much more likely that it's, you know, a genetic experiment escaped. Well, whereas if it's been around longer, it would be more likely to be something else.
Well, it's kind of like with Bigfoot, you know. I mean, with Bigfoot, I mean, the term Bigfoot was actually only introduced in the late 1950s. But, you know, you can go back into legends and stories and hear stories about wild men of the woods and things like this, but they're clearly talking about the same thing. But just the name Bigfoot didn't exist then, so people think, oh, because Bigfoot didn't exist before 59, why weren't people seeing it before? Well, the fact is they were, but they just had different names for it back then.
Yeah, the wild men. I mean, there's stories dating from, you know, colonial America on the East Coast of encounters with the wild men of the woods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can find those all around the world.
Yeah. So, you know, these stories have been around for a while. Now, as far as the chupacabra goes, are there any attacks ever been made on humans?
Well, I mean, I often get asked that question. The closest I can say is that when I've been on Puerto Rico, a number of people on probably not that many occasions, maybe four or five at most, have told me stories about how they'd heard about chupacabra attacks on people and how the government had hidden it all for fear of, you know, panic breaking out. And then in some cases, or a couple of cases, there were attacks. And I think it was in three cases, supposedly, bodies were found, you know, just torn apart and organs removed and massive amounts of blood gone, as if, you know, just attacked by some sort of savage creature. And supposedly, you know, everything was hidden under a smoke screen of, you know, let's just blame it, you know, let's put the blame on some sort of psychotic maniac or whatever. And I've tried to dig into those stories as deeply as possible, but I've never been able to get past, you know, well, I heard it from this person and they heard it from that person. You know, it's been sort of definitive, sort of friend of a friend stories. Now, that doesn't mean they're not true, because arguably the one thing more than any other would be if these creatures had gone from killing animals to killing people. You know, that would be the ultimate thing to cover up on the part of the government. So if these stories are true, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, we're getting the door shut in our faces every time we're trying to look into these stories. But, you know, just the very fact that I've heard, you know, sort of a handful of stories from different people on different parts of the island across, you know, the best part of half a decade, suggests that the very fact these stories are in circulation, there could well be something to them.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. It's kind of frightening to think of a creature that could attack a human and do that. I mean, it's one thing for it to be a goat, but for a human, it kind of switches up the odds.
Well, it does. But, I mean, you know, we always kind of think we're the sort of top dog, so to speak. But, I mean, you know, you can go to the zoo and see a lion, but you imagine if that glass wall wasn't there, you know, that you wouldn't last 2 minutes. You wouldn't last 2 seconds, you know.
I spend a lot of time hiking and camping, and I'm definitely afraid of bears. And have a very healthy respect for lions, you know, mountain lions. And, you know, they're both arch predators, and I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we might be scientifically the most advanced creature, but, you know, when you have animals that, I mean, physically, you know, I mean, chimpanzees, you know, they far outweigh us strength-wise. We're actually pretty low down on the scale in terms of actual physical strength and the ability to kill, you know, and kill quickly. You know, we are pretty low down. And of course, you know, look at animals like bats, you know, they have like their own, in simplistic terms, you know, they have their own form of almost like radar to negotiate and fly at night. You know, imagine the swallows, you know, to seek out smells and odors. You know, a lot of animals, their skills extend far beyond what we can do. You know, imagine a human being trying to make a spider's web. We'd never do it, you know. But you imagine if you see a fantastically, hugely spun spider's web, and it looks like the most amazing thing you could imagine. But we couldn't do it, you know. So I think, you know, we often don't give the animal kingdom the credit that it probably deserves. You know, they're just different to us, but they're superior to us in ways that we don't necessarily think of. And that could be the case with a chupacabra.
When you take away man's tools, we're kind of helpless.
It's pretty lame.
Literally,
man,
like
really.
Babies in the woods, you know?
Yeah, we're always complaining. Well, our internet's down, our cell phone's not working, you know. put us back in the, put us back in that environment where you've got to sort of catch a rabbit and find out which berries are okay to eat and which mushrooms are okay to eat, and you know, can you drink from this water? You know, a lot of people would not last, you know.
Yeah, you know, here in Mississippi, there's two berries that have very similar bushes. One's called a gallberry, and the other one's called a highbush blueberry. Or, what's the other name for it? Huckleberry. You know, real seedy, dry, blueberry-flavored berry. Well, gallberries are horrible tasting. That's why they're called gallberries. And if you get them in your mouth, I mean, you're going to make horrible taste. You're not going to die. I mean, you're not going to swallow it either, but you're not going to die. It just tastes dreadful. And I'm always mixing them up. Mm-hmm. And so when I go to taste a berry, it's like done very cautiously. You know, anytime we think of berries, I think, oh, yeah, gallberries. Oh, I love it when I misidentify those berries.
You know, I still remember that from Mississippi, so...
Yeah, I mean, wild blueberries are very common, too. They're delicious. But gallberries are not. They are the most horrible things you can possibly imagine. Bitter, ooh, yuck. I shiver even now just thinking about having them in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when you take away our tools, we are a rather helpless lot. We've only got about 5 minutes left now before the end of the program. Before we get started on another topic, you want to tell everybody where to get your book? Actually,
yeah,
books.
Sure. Yeah, well, the new book's called Keep Out, and it's a study of, it's not sort of a study of secret military installations per se, you know, from a military history perspective, but specifically places with links to UFOs and paranormal phenomena and things like this. So, Area 51, Hangar 18, the Russian Area 51, the British Area 51, things like the Dulce Base. The book's published by New Page Books, available, you know, whether online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, all good books selling places. And people contact me and learn more about the books at nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. And always pleased to chat with people. If they've got any questions, want to share stories, you know, always try and get back to people in sort of 24, 48 hours at the very most. As I said, always pleased to chat. I'm not one of these unapproachable, pompous authors who says, oh, leave me alone, I'm an author, you know, as if that means something, you know. Yeah, I'm always pleased to chat and, you know, sort of share information and see if we can figure out what's going on. And so.
Yeah, well, I know you're a lot of fun. You're a favorite guest with the audience. They love to hear you come talk about your books and, you know, all the different topics that you're so well versed in after your years of research. And, you know, you may not be rich in terms of dollars, but you certainly are rich in terms of knowledge and information, because there is so much out there that isn't just easily explained away.
No, and I always say to people as well, you know, part of it for me is the excitement of just living life. You know, I think, you know, we're all mortal, you know. We don't like to think of it, but at the end of the day, without getting depressive, we are, you know. So I always say just sort of seize life by the horns and just go for it, whatever it is you want to do in life. You know, what have you got to lose? You know, it's like I said, I left school at 16 with nothing, no qualifications, nothing. You know, what was I going to do? I could just wallow in misery and, oh, you know, poor old Nick. Well, no, so I decided I'm going to do something, you know, and anyone can achieve anything if they put their mind to it, you know, and it's good to have goals and be able to say, wow, you know, I did that and it worked, and, you know, then go on to the next challenge or whatever.
Well, yeah, and sometimes your challenges aren't necessarily things that you anticipated. If anybody had told me 10 years ago that I'd be sitting here on the radio talking with you, I would have laughed until I fell out of my chair. I had no aspiration for doing a radio show. So, you know, sometimes life takes some unexpected twists and turns, and you try something out that you hadn't thought of doing before and say, well, you know, I kind of like this. This is fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, your next book is going to be about pyramids, you said?
Well, yeah, well, actually, it's not just the pyramid. The title of the book is The Pyramids of the Pentagon. It'll be out in June, published by New Page Books again. And it's basically a study of how the government over the year, or actually governments around the world, have taken an interest in ancient artifacts. It's kind of like, I guess, a real-life study of real-life Indiana Jones types, except where instead of being archaeologists, they're actually people in governments. For example, there are chapters on things like the CIA search for the remains of Noah's Ark, the Pentagon's quest to literally find out the truth about the Ark of the Covenant, which kind of power the Indiana Jones story, Department of Defense files, which I got a hold of officially, talking about whether or not the pyramid, you know, could have been built by a levitation, British government files on Stonehenge, and all sorts of weird stuff where government agencies have taken a clear interest in everything from, like, Atlantis, ancient astronaut stories, you know, mysteries of, you know, the gods coming down from space, were they aliens, that sort of thing. And, you know, it's sort of really eye-opening to learn the extent to which government agencies have really pursued the issues of, like, ancient artifacts and ancient relics, that sort of thing.
You know, because it is, there's so many interesting things. So I'm assuming that since, you know, when this book's coming out, that one's largely, you know, wrapped up inside the bow. You have another one in the works?
Yeah, I've got one which will be coming out at the end of the year, or around the end of the year, called The World's Weirdest Places. And again, this is with New Page Books, and it's basically like a top 20, it's a look at the sort of, in my view, my sort of top 25 weird places around the world, where they're basically like paranormal hotspots where, you know, not just one place where something weird's happened, but say, for example, a spooky old, there's been everything from UFO encounters to Bigfoot to werewolves to ghosts. So in other words, it's like the area is like a magnet for weirdness, and I've sort of picked my favorite top 25 of those and putting them into chapters and, you know, describing what goes on at all these different places.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm going to have to make sure that I bring you back again so we can talk about them. But we are out of time now tonight. So, folks, we have run out of time, and like always, it's happened way too fast. I hope that everyone has found that tonight's program has given you plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week for another fascinating conversation that's also sure to have plenty of food for thought. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.